Thank you very much for this kind introduction. I want to start first with an expression of my gratitude for the stay here. I'm very happy to be here to do my research in this very inspiring and international atmosphere. Despite of my English, I would like to apologize for my English. It is not as good as I would like it have to be. But I will do my best. I want to start with an art piece, a short introduction just for tuning in, because this is the first lecture of this year, and I think it's a good sign for a new year. It was a kind of starting point for modern sculpture. It is more than 100 years old, and it is called The Sleeping Muse, La Muse Dormée, oder Die Schlafende Muse. And I love it very much. It is so calm, so peaceful, and so full of ideas and inspiration. That's the reason I love it. Just take a look and read this quote from the artist. I think it's a very good starting point too for our topic of the day. Here you can see my outline for today. My main topic for this lecture is the relevance of rituals and the relevance of aesthetics, both for social order and for identity. In the first section, I want to go on ritual theory, and of course, especially rituals of predictions, but I would like to start with everyday life rituals, with interaction rituals, because I think it is crucial to understand first this rituals in everyday life before we go beyond everyday life. My second point will be the role of aesthetics. And in the last part, I will go to a field study I have made in the last weeks in Berlin, according to this topic in the consortium here. Okay, let us start. Now comes my theoretical starting point. The philosophical anthropology with Helmut Plessner, of one of the main authors, is for me a very good starting point, because this approach understands the human existence as determined in a double way, but still with space for free will and creativity. That's an important point. Double determined means by culture and by nature. Humans are biological beings like other creatures, and they are shaped crucially by culture and society too. It means that the nature of human beings is to have culture, because human beings are not sufficiently adapted to natural surroundings. Helmut Plessner founded the concept of eccentric positionality. That's not easy to translate. In German, exzentrische Positionalität. Eccentric positionality of humans. This concept means that human beings are part of nature through their body, and at the same time they are outside of nature through their cognitive abilities. On the one hand, we are beings like other beings with a sense of nature, mostly aware of our body and his needs and feelings and his ties to other creatures, plants, and nature itself. On the other hand, we have an open intentionality, surplus energy, which can be shaped by cultural forms. Therefore, we have a great range of different cultures. A famous sentence from Helmut Plessner is, in the German discourse of course, I translate it, "We are our body and we have our body at the same time. We do not only live, but we have to lead our life." In the human existence, there's always a fascinating tension, and sometimes even a thrilling contradiction between two poles, the natural and the cultural dimension of existence. And especially in modern societies, these two aspects have fallen apart and disintegrated. My starting hypothesis is that rituals are a classical social pattern which integrates the bodily existence and the sensual perception into culture and into natural environment. Rituals are a way to stabilize the eccentric and tensionful human way of life and to connect with the community and with the natural surroundings. Rituals are fundamental for social order, for stability, and for change of a community and of a society. I would like to distinguish some different types of rituals. They are overlapping, of course. First, we have everyday life rituals, mostly called interaction rituals. The second types are the kind of rituals which are religious or spiritual, or rites de passage, changing rituals, changing biography, or changing societies. And the third kind is prediction rituals, of course, because this is a topic of the consortium. First, I want to stress everyday life rituals. I think that's important if we want to investigate the borders between everyday life and other modes of perception. We first should have an intensive look on the structure of perception in everyday life and the interaction rituals in everyday life. The author who investigated interaction rituals in a classical way is Erwin Goffman. He examined rituals of kindness and politeness, a kind of secular rituals, but there's the question if there is a rest of something sacred in this everyday life rituals. A contemporary sociologist working on interaction rituals too, interaction rituals and emotional energy, that is Randall Collins, and I admire his work very much. Everyday life rituals regulate social interactions, like a script or a kind of grammar, with a system of rules used in a tacit way, hidden way, but mostly right, without explicit applying the underlying rules, like a grammar. When we say hello or goodbye, when we are opening or closing a conversation, when we surrender speech, when we are polite to each other, when we knock on a door, or when we are delicate and tactful, then we are using interactional rituals, this system of rules. We don't want the other person, or we ourselves, losing face. Therefore, we avoid to come too close to other persons, knocking on doors, for example, or keeping a specific spatial distance in interaction. We avoid to hurt his or her boundaries in order of the personal rights of every person in social contact. We avoid to miss a social role or a social mask for ourselves and for other persons. Interaction rituals include ceremonial acts and rules of acting, rules of speech, rules of distances in various situations, rules of body containment and rules of body language, like pulling the head or shaking hands, face expressions, and so on. We have a culture-shaped system of rules, and at the core of the system, and this is a very interesting point, is the idea of honoring the other, worshipping the concept of personality, which means to accept another standpoint in the world. That's a fundamental philosophical problem in a phenomenological view, and now I will stress some complex thoughts of a famous phenomenologist like Maurice Merleau-Ponty, Jean-Paul Sartre, and Emmanuel Levinas. In everyday life, not in science, but in everyday life, our perception is centered in the center of our body, perceiving and experiencing everything from a centered perspective. Not in science. Here we have a concept of perception which is abstract, not bounded on a specific point in space or time, not located in specific surroundings, but put in an abstract system of space and time, independent from a concrete actor or observer. But in everyday life, our perception is centered to our own body, to the living, actively perceiving body. In German language, we have two words for the body, Körper and Leib. In English, there are no expressions which are fitting for this difference. The term Leib means the body from an inner perspective, including feelings, spontaneous impulses, vitality, or even pains. It means the living body and its experiences, impulses, and motions. The term Körper means the social formed body, body as an instrument for specific social formed and trained action, for high developed actions like sports or dancing or handicrafts or surgery. Our body as a system which can be repaired. That is an underlying assumption in modern medicine. You could say in ancient medicine mostly the Leib was treated, in modern medicine mostly the Körper is repaired with medicine or surgery. Let us now go back to the fundamental phenomenological problem of social interaction as described by Sartre and Levinas. Every interaction contains a basic problem of understanding the other. Between ego and alter is a border, a gap. They are both socially shaped with great parts of common knowledge and common parts of identity, but there is always a gap too. We may be very familiar and close to a person, sharing many experiences and many zones of tacit knowledge, but in every interaction, even in very familiar relationships, there is a moment of alienation too. Because we don't really know what the other person is feeling, thinking, and sometimes even exactly meaning with the words he or she is using. An interesting point is the other way round counts too. That means even in cultural very unfamiliar human interactions, we have always a moment of likeness or familiarity. Alfred Schütz and Thomas Luckmann, Luckmann and Schütz, I think they are called in English, they are founders of a German school of a phenomenological-based sociology. They used for this phenomena the term mid-level transcendency. I think I have a... Yeah. Mid-level transcendency of perception in the life world. They examined the structures of knowledge and perception in the life world. There is a minor and a major transcendency too. The minor transcendency of perception is a spatial one. That means I can't see now what happens in the other room or at home in this moment. The mid-level transcendency of perception is a social one. That means I can't see what happens in the mind of my interaction partners. And the major one is time-bounded. That means I can't know what will happen tomorrow or after my death or before my birth. An interesting point is, of course, that we have social means and resources to overcome partially these transcendental borders. Means like scrolls, books, photographs, cameras, and so on. And these means are developing very fast in our present times. The social type of this transcendency with its borders of perception, the gap between ego and alter, faces us with a problem that mostly only sociologists have, I think. The problem, how collective life is possible. How is understanding and social interaction in general is possible. In the life world, we have social means to overcome this gap between ego and alter and to bridge the different standpoints in the life world with idealistic assumptions, idealisierungen, Schütz called them. This is the assumption of reciprocity of our perspective, which means I could place myself in your shoes and the other way around. If I had your profession or your biography, I would see the world in the same way you do, and so on. These are, of course, idealistic assumptions, but they are working mostly, and they rule the life world. We mostly can understand each other proper enough for interaction and collaboration. Interaction rituals are both expression as well as tools of these idealistic assumptions in everyday life. They are an instrument of fundamental and, of course, of political relevance too, because interaction rituals are crucial for civilization and cultivation, a kind of micro work on social order. This micro-work in everyday life is important for society as a kind of resistance against the always existing social entropy. Sartre and Levinas, Emmanuel Levinas, wrote about the moment when ego meets alter and a social situation is starting. They wrote from a phenomenological view, of course. In the moment when ego faces alter, there is a moment of alienation, because in the glaze of alter, the pure being of ego will be shattered. His flow of consciousness and his standpoint in the life world became questionable. The presence of alter turns ego from a subject to an object of perception. Therefore, interaction contains always a moment of irritation. It is like a disruption of the flow of consciousness, like an existential indecision. After this irritation, there are now different possibilities to act. The first and best one is to use interaction rituals for bridging the gap between ego and alter, as a kind of ceremonial worshipping the other person, with bridging rituals of politeness. Therefore, these rituals are a very important social tool for cultivation, a tool of huge political importance, and sometimes the cover of civilization is rather thin. Because there are other possible reactions to this moment of irritation. For example, defeating the other, even using violence, or trying to destroy this other with his alien characteristics and other standpoint in the world. You can see this kind of reaction in political phenomena like xenophobia or sexual violence against women. For me, a very interesting point is that Levinas described this moment of alienation, irritation in social context as an ethical challenge, of course, but also as an aesthetical challenge. And he meant not the surface of the other person. The experience of the presence of alter can be a very powerful aesthetical experience. It can cause a rip in the natural given character of everyday life. This rip is mostly covered in social life by the social tools we talked about. But this challenge could be experienced in special intensive encounters, for example, in arts or in other intensive encounters. The conclusion is that interaction rituals are a very, very crucial element of society. Interaction rituals are a social tool for bridging the ethical challenge of interaction and, moreover, for dealing with the aesthetical challenge of interaction as well. Interaction rituals are a more secular phenomenon, but they include a sacred core, the sacralization of personality. Even modern societies need this sacred element at their core for functioning, because this element of interaction is restricting the possibility of violence, of anomie, and social entropy. Anomie is a term from Emil Durkheim, which means the lack of social norms and interaction rituals are managing the situation of contingency in everyday life and make every interaction more reliable and more predictable. Now let us go to the second type of rituals, to the religious or spiritual rituals, rite de passage. In modern societies, we have a separation of political and everyday life from the religious or spiritual context. Pre-modern society mostly don't have this separation. Sacred rites are more integrated in everyday life. But nevertheless, for the practice of rituals, it is in general important to mark a special space, a special time period, and a special form of perception and communication during the ritual process. The kind of perception and the mode of communication in the ritual are different from everyday life communication. We are going now to Victor Turn and his theoretical concept of social structure in everyday life and anti-structure in the ritual process. Victor Turner founded the Manchester School of Anthropology. He investigated rituals in southern Africa, especially at the tribe of the Ndembu, and developed a theoretical and generalized models of rituals in cultural comparison. These rituals are mostly a social instrument for dealing with changes. That may be changes in role or age position, the rite de passage. That may be spatial changes or seasonal changes, very important. Or maybe a playful attempt of mastering new collective challenges. There are always two ways of social life and social communication. The first one takes place in everyday life with a specific set of rules, of roles, of positions and possessions, and specific social differences. The second one takes place in rituals and is called communitas, with the term of Victor Turner. And this way of communication is more aesthetical, more equal, more emotional than the routinized and limited communication of everyday life. We have three phases of rituals. The first one is a separation, the second one is liminality or communitas, and the third one is reaffiliation. Separation means and symbolizes the leaving of the social roles and possessions. Typical for this phase are cleaning rituals or undressings. You have to go over symbolic thresholds or spatial thresholds, leaving identity and to go to another mode of communication or perception. The second phase is the core of the ritual. It means transition or liminality. Victor Turner called it communitas. It's a very important term, communitas. In this phase, the usual social order has been suspended and is no longer valid. All persons are equal in the ritual, but there may be a ceremonial master, of course. We have often a use of symbolics like white clothes, or nudity even. Symbolic characteristics are too silence, humility, poverty, purity, death, and resurrection. In the ritual, challenges are to be mastered, for example, in initiation rituals. Transitions and changes of identity are made possible in this mode. The change takes place in a sensible, emotional, and sometimes in a physical way. For example, sometimes the change is written into the body. You can find this in initiation rituals. You can see a liberation of emotions and collective energies, cathartic transformations of these energies, and a vitalization of the collective at the end. And sometimes this phase includes reversals of the social order. There are many examples for it. The third phase is that of reaffiliation, that means return to the social order, the usual rules, and the usual status or the new status are now valid. A new social role, a new identity has been acquired. The ritual initiates a necessary change and at the same time a vitalization of the community. Therefore, rituals are crucial for the revitalization and for the stability of communities and for changing abilities too, for reacting to challenges. Rituals have a known aesthetical order to create another mode of communication and perception. In modern society, the classical rituals with a liminal character have not disappeared but are reduced to some rests, like christenings or wedding rituals or funerals, carnival, Christmas and New Year celebrations, we had it. The last 2 weeks, or Eastern Furthermore, we can find much new phenomena with a liminoid character, not liminal, but liminoid. They're like rituals, but not in a religious, not in a strictly religious way. For example, cultural events in arts and music, in sport, in politics, and so on. But mostly we don't have much awareness about the role of these rituals. Victor Turner identified a dialectic relation between the two fundamental social modes, between structure and anti-structure, communitas. He saw here a tension. There should always be a rhythmic flow, an alternation between social structure and communitas. If the alternation of social structure and communitas is blocked, derailments would take place. For example, in this perspective, the Russian Revolution can be understood as an attempt to establish communitas as a lasting, permanent mode, and it ended at the opposite side, in a congealed, crusted society. This attempt had to fail because it is impossible to establish communitas in a permanent mode. And the other way around too, if a society is crusted and blocked and has no vivid motions between structure and communitas, the opposite would rise and emerge suddenly, like riots or revolts, as a form of communitas. Rituals are an essential part of community and society for both, to deal with the problem of social accordance and stability, and to deal with the problem of necessary change. Change as an answer to challenges from the surroundings, or change as a necessary motion for the society itself. Now I come to the next type of rituals, to the prognostic rituals. Since I'm here in the consortium, I had the chance to participate on some discussions about different types of prognosis. We have predictions in everyday life as a characteristic of action plans of human beings. Before we act, we have mostly a sketch of purposes, of aims, and motives in the action, and of our possibilities to be successful. The second type of prediction or prognosis, as a result of a systematically evaluated experience or scientifically analyzed data, maybe big data, or as a computed result of a complex mathematical or statistical model, like the weather forecast or like poll extrapolations. And the third type is divination or prophecy, and there we have two types. The inspired divination, a form of direct divination through a medium, and the other is the hermeneutic divination through interpreting signs. All the various types of prediction, everyday life predictions, scientific prognosis, and divinations are including rituals. There are rituals of performing the prediction and rituals of generating predictions. The performative rituals are communicating the prognosis into a social context. This type of rituals is important to gain social acceptance and validity for the prediction, when predictions are part of a political process. The second type are those prognostic rituals in which the prediction itself is generated. If we ask what is specific for prediction rituals compared to other kinds of rituals, my answer would be they're dealing with contingency in a special way. All kinds of rituals are good instruments for dealing with social contingency because of their ability to bring the community in accordance and to generate, therefore, social reliability. And because of their ability to generate a way for necessary change. But prognostic rituals are dealing not only with a social contingency, but also with a time-bounded contingency, which means we do not know what next year or in 50 years will happen. The major transcendence called by Schütz-Luckmann. They are attempts to get knowledge about things we cannot know, to reduce contingency about important common or private issues. Will we have good circumstances for political decisions or not? Will we have good fortune in family life or in public affairs? Will there be conflicts with other countries or not? And so on. The prediction rituals have to deal with the basic problem of contingency, including the undetermined future of developments, crises, turning points. Prediction rituals are processed in another, not in the usual mode of perception and communication. In everyday life perception and communication, it is not possible to see what will happen tomorrow or next year. We can distinguish different conceptions of time: cyclic time, linear time, and eternal time. Our contemporary understanding of time is linear. We can imagine it like a line which is running in one direction, not reversible. With many infinite points of time with the same distance. Pre-modern society mostly had a cyclic understanding of time as a process which is related to nature and to rhythmic events, with a repetition of seasons, with birth and death and rebirth of nature during the season, and so on. Labor, family life and celebrations were related to the seasons. Our holidays or holy days are still related to the seasons, but our social life is more and more ruled by the linear time concept. The more activities and processes are to coordinate, the more important is a linear time concept. But there are some rests of cyclic time due to the human body, especially due to the life aspect of the body. Human body is working in rhythmic processes: the heartbeat, the blood circuit, the rhythm of activity and sleep and rest and so on. The human body is rhythmic. Now I come to my next point, to the relevance of aesthetics. Give me one moment. The hypothesis I'm presenting is the human sense of aesthetics is not subsidiary. It is crucial for the social abilities of humans, for sociality. We call it in German Sozialität. It is hard to translate to. In sociology, we have a new discussion about the role of aesthetics, but this discussion mainly goes about the elite character of aesthetics, or about aesthetics as an instrument of capitalism, of cultural and consumer economics, or about aesthetic as a new dispositive, according to Foucault, as an instrument for self-control and self-shaping. In the perspective of most of my sociological colleagues, aesthetics are an element of oppression, which is supporting illegitimate power structures. That's not my opinion. Maybe, but that's not all of it, I would say. What I want to say is aesthetics are a crucial part of rituals in general, and I think of sociality, of socialität in general. The oldest finds of human history show us that aesthetics belong to the social life of humans from the beginning. Among the oldest finds, there is color powder dated back for 250,000 years, probably used for body or wall painting. This is only one example, of course. There are much more, like the Ice Age art, or the Cage of Chauvet, or the Cage of Lascaux. There about 20 to 30,000 years old. The ritual process is taking place in a way of perception which is not like everyday-like perception. To start a ritual, there is a need for a shift in perception, for stepping over the threshold. The perception of everyday life is ruled by routines because it is more functional. The existence of human beings is in a large part ruled by socially shaped routines. This is the reason for having a free mind and capacity when they have to face a real new problem which needs creativity. But in ritual, it is like in arts. You get to knead out from these routines. Max Imdahl, a German historian of arts, had good terms for two different modes of perception: seeing as recognizing and seeing as seeing. I translate this. In German, it is called Wiedererkennendes Sehen and Sehendes Sehen. The recognizing way of seeing is used mostly in everyday life. It means to see something and to recognize the familiar or typical aspects, and they put it fastly into a pre-existing structure to add it to a category and to react in a way we know and have been experienced before. The seeing as seen means a different, much more aesthetical way of perception. It means a fully awake attention for every special and characteristic element of a thing, or of an art piece, or of a person. For every tiny echo of a staged music piece, or the thousand hermeneutic shades of a word or sentence in a specific situation. This way of perception can irritate people. It could drive you crazy if you miss to come back to everyday life mode of perception. But it can make people suffused and happy about the new insights or about a very fresh glance on the world, and could cause you to feel vivid in a full way. This way of perception is an attitude which could be developed, training senses for small differences and tiny shades of sounds, words, or colors. This way of perception is important for producing arts, music or painting or dancing or other arts, and also as an attitude for an intensive reception of art pieces. In this respect, religion is related or similar to arts, or let me say, arts have inherited religion. Arts are using similar ways, similar kinds of perception. For practicing rituals in a full sense, and I don't mean cold ceremonies as some which do not longer mean much anything to anybody. I mean hot ceremonies, those in which the participants are involved and highly committed. For these rituals, you need this extraordinary way of perception. You need to leave the everyday life mode, to shift to a kind of perception in which the usual borders don't count and things can be appreciated which aren't present in everyday life and couldn't be perceived before. This mode of perception is ruled by a specific aesthetical order, an order of sounds, words, colors, pictures, symbols, ritual objects, and so on. For summarizing, I would like to emphasize the ritual character of prediction and, within the ritual process, the aesthetics of the ritual as my main focus to analyze prediction and divination. And now I want to go to my field study. To examine my hypothesis and for further development of my approach, I have done some field studies in contemporary society, of course, because I'm a sociologist, and the present society is my main research field. I experimented with some practice of rituals. For example, since some weeks, I'm using the I Ching several times a week, and it's very useful, I think. But mainly, I investigated the contemporary practice of tarot. After studying some literature, I made contact with a young female artist in Berlin, practicing tarot as a ritual as well as an art project. I decided to join such a ritual for a participant observation, Teilnehmende Beobachtung in German, and for a narrative interview with a tarot artist as a part of my field study. Let me call her Anna. Of course, it is a pseudonym. She's living in Berlin since 2 years and finishing her studies in fine arts in Buenos Aires. She is from Argentina. For her master's thesis, she developed a project about tarot. Oh, that's not the right thing. She developed a project about tarot. It's called The Fool's Journey, or El Viaje del Loco, or Die Reise des Narren. A project of performing arts and a personal quest at the same time. I have collected visual material about this tarot performance, Anna staged in Berlin in 2015 and 16, and analyzed the material. After that, in late November 2016, I traveled to Berlin to participate in a tarot ritual and to make an interview with Anna. The Fool is a figure of the tarot cards of the Great Arcana, and Anna identified herself as the figure of the Fool. Beyond Tarot, the Fool is an archetypical figure with a great ritual character. Victor Turner wrote it earlier. This figure is always at the edge of society, and the usual modes of communication and of social structure don't count for the Fool. This figure is free to say many things anybody else is not allowed to say. As a trickster, how anthropologists call him, he could fool the ruler, cheat everybody, including the elite, always at the edge of possible words and actions. He could put the usual order upside down or from head to the feet. The Fool, as well as the hermit or the poor ascetic monk, they are classical figures with characteristics of communitas. Not wealthy, not really influential, poor and independent, with much freedom to observe social conditions and to talk about it, but always risky, dangerous life at the edge of society. The ritual in which I participated took place in Berlin at the end of November in a small flat which is usually used by a healer called Ludovica. She's from Italy. She's working with shamanic methods and she's studying shamanism at an international society for shamanism in Austria. This ritual, called Walking the Tarot, is staged in the last week of every month and is led by Anna and Ludovica. It is including shamanic elements and is working mainly with the tarot cards. The monthly tarot ritual started at 9 p.m. and took about 1 hour. The participants were 11 young people from 25 to 30 years, most of them women, from all over Europe, living in Berlin. English was spoken in general. A fresh and vivid international atmosphere took place when people arrived and welcomed each other. Most of them knew each other, obviously, and usually meet every month for this ritual. Considering methodological rules of a qualitative research, it was clear for me that I had to participate in a way which does not disturb, does not change the way the ritual took place without my research. So I had to assimilate myself to the community as good as possible. The room was heated and warm and filled with a kind of meditative music. When the ritual started, the participants sat down in a circle on pillows at the floor. The music was turned off and the light was dimmed to a very low level. Ludovica burned some incense to clear the atmosphere and to create the space for the ritual. Anna said in the interview we made the next day, "Creating the space is super important. The room you create is always a task. And with shamanism, the tools I use are the ones we experienced yesterday. So the first opening of the room is with sounds. Then you let know the spirits you are starting to work and that you are calling them. You work with the center and say hi to the spirits, and then you go to the four cardinal points to do the same code in the four directions. Then you go back to the center, you go around, and you create the borders of the space." After this opening, every participant could choose a percussion instrument, and we walked around in a circle, drumming the instruments, feeling common with the collective rhythm and the collective motion. After doing this for a long while, for about 15 minutes, a vague impression of trance was in the room. Then we stopped walking, put back the percussions and sat down in the circle. Anna mixed the tarot cards, only the great arcana, divided the deck and pulled the card on the top of the deck. She pulled a second card, which was under the divided deck. She said the first card is the main card for this evening and for the following month. The second card is accompanying to give some more hints for the interpretation. The first card which was pulled is the card number 8, number 13. The card number 13, without name, it is this one, often called the Death, Anna said. The card was given around in the circle, and every participant should regard the card with its pictures and symbols and consider the meaning of the card for him or her personally. After that, we walked the second time with drumming the percussions. We should try to come deeper to the experience of the card. Me, for myself, I found it hard to get in a deeper contact with the death. And maybe the other participants had similar feelings. I saw that some of them didn't look very comfortable. After walking this way, Anna explained the card in an extensive way for at least 10 minutes. The meaning of the card has not to be a physical death, but it has the meaning of things coming to an end, of maybe great upcoming changes. It could mean a loss, including pain or difficulties, but it also means closing processes and harvesting results of processes, making space for a new cycle. The card is a hint to let go, to leave obsolete circumstances, and to give place to necessary change. The next day, Anna said in the interview, "If tarot is a journey, then all cards are good. There are no bad or good cards because they are reflecting all the possibilities. All cards are my friends." That's a smart opinion, of course, but it is not easy to be befriended with death. I did my best. Anna took the second card, which was under the divided deck. The second card was the Chariot. Number 7. She explained the meaning of this card, which is symbolizing changes and transformations too, but in a more positive manner, including the abilities to manage this change with all difficulties. It means winning power and being focused and successful. To connect with a decisive power is advised by this card. After the explanations and interpretation of the card, the ritual was closed with thanks to the spirits. The participants left the room and chatted for a while in the very narrow hallway and the small kitchen of the flat before they said goodbye. In the last week of the year, of the last year, Anna wrote me an email. We exchanged best wishes for the new year and invitations, and she wrote, "By the way, this month we did walking the tarot a week earlier because of the Christmas celebration. It came, the card number 8, Justice, in front, and number 6, the Lovers on the back. New balance and renewed love and joy after the intense and sometimes dark energy of the 3rd in the Arcane without name. Interesting combination to open a new cycle and a new year." The day after the ritual, we made an interview. I made an interview with Anna in her room in a flat in Berlin, Neukölln, which she is sharing with 2 other international students. It was not the flat of the ritual. This interview was verbally transcribed afterwards, and examining it, I found some more very interesting details about this kind of ritual. Now I'm going to present some quotes of the interview, of my material. About this card, we talked a lot in the interview. The next day, it is a bird, and she explained the very complex symbols on the surface of this card, and in the middle is the dancing soul. I love this card most. Good. Quote from the interview. The first one is about using random and coincidences for a creative process, for the ritual, and for the artist work too. It is about learning and practicing tarot too, of course. Anna understands tarot as a mirror for life and her own experiences in life as a mirror for the meaning of the tarot card, for the system of tarot cards. I asked her, "Is this tarot reading like a game for you, or is it serious stuff?" And she said, "It is both. Of course, the part of a game is also something that attracts, because I trust a lot in synchronicity and in random. I also use it as a creative process, the accidents and how you can use them. I think the game gives you the chance to explore, to play with stuff, to be flexible. It is more like an open attitude, but the task is serious," she said. And what is a task? I asked her. She said, not really to predict the future. It is about to learn something about life. It is a process of communication to learn what the cards mean. And you connect your experience to the card, and the experience helps you to understand what the card means. And the card helps you to understand your situation. It is really working like that. It mirrors. And she said, with this intention to understand tarot through life and to understand life through tarot. The second point, more quotes from the interview. This point is about the shift in perception. Anna said, before reading, I put the deck in order, so I follow the order with the numbers. When a person mixes, the moment of mixing, the person is focusing on what they want to ask, and they create their own chaos. And they mix without seeing, and so their unconscious is working, and you do not see. You do not see it. You are not aware of it or controlling it. So you mix, and in this moment you create a chaos, and you think of all aspects of a situation. They come to your mind or heart. It is like an intuition. Well, let's go to the next point. And I think this is really very important. It's about one moment, please. It's about fate, free will, and responsibility. And Anna thought a lot about it. She said, reading the future is really dangerous because in the moment of reading, there's the person that comes and both are involved and are opening their unconsciousness. And when the card comes, the picture is like printed in your unconsciousness. And your unconsciousness is actually the creator of your reality. So then your unconsciousness will work secretly for this event to happen. So what I want to say is, to read the future is dangerous, because then you are conditioning the person that this will happen, and then probably it will. And she said, we are partly creators, we are partly also not. And that is a great balance of life. There are things beyond control, but there is also a free will. That is why future is something we really cannot know. Maybe the persons do not see their actions create the future. And then they are putting themselves out of the center of their life. And when they are talking about, will this happen or not, they are asking just for the circumstances. I think this counts for every kind of prediction. A prediction could cause a self-fulfilling prophecy when the person for whom the prediction was made believes in it. Or it could cause the opposite, to act in order to avoid the prediction with every possibility of acting. Maybe you remember the Greek myth of Oedipus. It could be both, too. A story of avoiding a prediction and a self-fulfilling prophecy at the same time. Anna said for her, tarot is not about reading the future, but more to come to more possibilities, to see some aspects of a situation, of the past or of the present the person is, and maybe sometimes to get some hints what would be the best way to act in the future. The next point is about ritual as a social process. The social dynamics are elementary part of the ritual. Anna said, so what is very important for this and why it is so interesting as a performance and a social process is to connect not only with the interdependency of everything which is creating this moment, but it is also to connect with the community, because we are social. The answer comes in this process, in this meeting, in this interaction, in this openness. And it is always like a surprise for everyone who is involved in the process. Now to my last point about using aesthetical elements for creating the process of ritual. And Anna did it in a very well considered way. She said, so when I first knew I want to work with tarot, then second I want to work with shadow theater. Because I saw the similarity between the cards and this three-dimensional language of the pictures in the Middle Age churches. It was the same aesthetics, bloodline, color, form. And the shadow theater gives you the possibility to upgrade the cards into a living puppet or in a moving picture. Therefore, is the shadow theater pretty close to hallucination of non-ordinary reality. And the shadow theater is a language of unconsciousness, because we somehow have to complete the picture. It is all the time playing with our suggestion. I wanted to make a collective oracle, which is a challenge, because the usually settings are one-to-one, so two persons. So how to create this deep level of communication within a group? Which kind of conscious and questions is showing up in a collective setting? I wanted to do something that involves interaction, and I noticed that this was a very good idea and also a very difficult idea. You need to have everything prepared and then show up, but there's a huge part of improvisation. The presence of the people will change the artwork is not fixed. The improvisation should let it alive and surprise ourselves what is happening. The elements, the audience, the performers, we are all in the same place. We are all making the journey. That's the performance, the journey of the fool. Die Reise des Narren. Then the people. The audience is the fool somehow, bringing in their self, their creativity, their questions, and we are all sharing the same space. Anna said to create a round space is a proper way for this form of performance she wanted to stage, because it is suitable for the dynamics of communication and collective behavior. The performance should connect the people who are participating with the group and connect them with all the senses, with the elements of nature. Therefore, she uses the elements or symbols for the elements, for fire, for earth, for water, and for air. She said for fire, in the beginning she's using fire and smoke, cleaning the space with the smoke. She said, sometimes I also made in the round tent a circle of fire. I use fire a lot as well outside. Then comes the earth. She said, I use a lot of clay, tone. And she so showed me a sample of her clay in a glass, put it in a glass. She said, I use it for skin, you see it in the picture. It is a great body painting. It is a connection with the earth. It is also a great part of the costumes. Then she said, between the performers and the audience, we touch the audience. First you have smell and then the touch. It is about shortening the distance between us. We are challenging the audience all the time, and there's a lot of the clown is super powerful, it is a fool, and so we have to use it. Take the people out of their comfort zone, that is super important to create a space of sharing. You have an impression, the clay is used for this mask on the face. The next element is water. She said, for water, I use different ways. For example, using it together with the clay, painting on skins, on the skins. Or sharing water with the audience, drinking of cups of transparent glass with words on it. Us, you and I, respectively in three languages, in English, German and Spanish. Like a symbol for sharing feelings. She said, okay, we start from this us, that ocean that we all are merged in. Then we put water in the two cups. First I was drinking from the cup of the I, and I giving the person from the you then we exchanged little details. And this we did with the whole public, so it took a while. Then for the air, the next element is the air. For the air, we had many ideas, but the one I love is the most effective. We have a pillow, and there are words on the pillow. The pillow is usually the place where you rest your head, full of dreams and ideas. That was usually the last step of the four elements. And this pillow, written with words, we put in the middle and sacrificed it. Knife and cut, the knife is the sword, the element that sharps, that cuts reality, the intellect. But with this, we sacrifice, we break the pillow and we let the feathers inside the pillow free. And then the feathers are all there, and it brings back the idea of unconsciousness. We sacrifice something that human created to rest themselves, to create a moment of chaos. Another way to a moment of chaos, which is also very important in her opinion, is for the ritual. Another way was, used it too, to use completely darkness for some minutes. And in this darkness, she went through the audience, interacting with people in a completely unknown situation. So now I come to the conclusions. aesthetics and sensual elements are needed for the shift from the perception of everyday life to a kind of perception which is needed in rituals. Examples have been given, like opening the space, using symbols for the elements, connecting the community with another kind of reality. There are some similarities between arts and rituals, but some differences too. What counts for both is you need another way of perception, the seeing. An attempt to get new and surprising insights, a playful, curious opinion, using and creating specific aesthetics. Despite of the special character of my field study, I think it shows the fundamental meaning of a deliberate aesthetics for a ritual process. Maybe I was very lucky with this key informant, with Anna. She was my field partner, because she's both well-educated in fine arts and experienced in rituals too. But I think if you ask an old priest of any religion, maybe he would also talk explicitly about the aesthetical elements of his ritual processes. Mostly this part of the education to reflect on symbols and on aesthetics. Another interesting point was is using to make use of random and coincidences. It is part of the ritual process of this middle part to produce random or even chaos. To open perception and to decouple it from social structure and from everyday life, to make perceptions possible which are not possible in everyday life. Then to suit the random and chaos events into the aesthetic and symbolic order of the ritual. And the last point is, there's a moment of reflecting the potential dangerous outcomes of the rituals. There are manipulation of the participants in the sense of self-fulfilling prophecies or creating lasting fears or illusions. I think that may count for every prediction. The ritual experts may limit the potential outcome of the prediction, at least if they are aware of this danger and don't want to use it in a political sense, of course. They may do this before starting the performance, because during the performance the ritual has its own dynamics, which is created partly collective. Okay, now I'm at the end. Many thanks for your attention.